Hi, you're tuned to KBOO Portland. This is Locus Focus. I'm Stephanie Potter, acting as guest host today. I'm sitting in for Barbara Bernstein. My guest today, Hank Patton, is someone who envisions a world where resources are basically managed as if the future mattered. He's coming here from the Columbia Gorge. He also brought his daughter, Amelia Patton Hall, with him.
Amiel.
I keep saying that wrong. Amiel. And he's founded something 30 years ago called World Steward at the mouth of the Little White Salmon River in the Columbia Gorge. And the center apparently is offering educational opportunities in the stewardship of farm and forest land. And he's also into promoting local economies there and fostering community. World Steward is also fostering intergenerational finance. And Amory Lovins, who's the chairman, chief environmental scientist of the Rocky Mountain Institute, has called this intergenerational finance perhaps the most important new idea to enter economic thought in this century. It's pretty amazing. IGF, it's also called that, has the potential to harness trillions of dollars, I believe, for sustainable business practices and infrastructure. So I want to talk about all of this with you today, and hopefully we can make it all make sense.
That's an ambitious goal.
Right. So anyway, Hank, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
And welcome, Amiel.
Thank you.
Okay, so I read about what you and your friends have been doing in the gorge these last, I guess it's actually almost 40 years, it's beyond 30. And it seems to me that your work is kind of a three-legged stool. There's the educational, environmental part of it. There's the environmental education part of it. There's also protecting farm and forest land. And there's this idea of helping develop business as if the future actually matters. And that's a big list. So do you work on these as separate projects, or is there a sort of a common denominator or common vision holding them all together?
Well, that's a great question. What I think we've found is that the common denominator is the business of delivering value to those who come after us, which is something that I think every parent holds in their heart, because we look out at a world that's very complicated and unstable, and we wonder how to deliver value to the world that our children are going to be living in. So education for me has become the stewardship learning idea, the idea of introducing kids to the natural world in a landscape, has become an opportunity to realize that generosity in nature in an economic way. And that's a common thread. It allows us to introduce learning experiences that teach science and math and other basic skills. But it also allows us to apply those skills to things that are useful, like producing food and sustaining soil and habitat and carbon and fresh water. And of course, those in this locus focus conversation have big implications for the rest of the world, which is where we talk about managing resources in an economic way that sustain and deliver value to future generations. So there really is a common thread, depending on whether the fences are down and the horses and cows are out. Of course, we start on different activities in the morning, and you've got the daily work. But then there's also the larger questions. We think of it as kind of takes 2 feet to walk. You do the local stuff, but you also have to do the big picture work.
And you sort of refer to that as glocus or glocal?
Glocality.
Glocality, yeah.
It's a wonderful word. What it gets us to think about is the local activities that have global implications. The motto for us is that world order actually begins in the kitchen sink, which I think is the little watershed, the smallest river. And it's the one that flows right through the middle of your family, right where your food is being prepared.
And then eventually out to the ocean, where it connects with everything in the world.
Absolutely, and yeah. Comes back to us through the rain systems. And if we get that right, we have clean, stable systems. And if we get it wrong, we have chaos for, obviously, all of us are concerned about what's going to happen in these seasons ahead.
Well, just specifically before we get more into it, because I really do want to talk about intergenerational finance, intergenerational, it's such a huge topic, but just specifically a little more about World Steward. So you're out in the Columbia Gorge near the Little White Salmon River, and how many acres is that?
Well, there are 14 pieces of land and 13 of them are now protected permanently. We're working on the last one. It's set up as a permanent endowment. The lands are in a protected trust. We partner with a diversity of organizations and agencies to do that. There are some critical wildlife functions that were the basis of the grants, the most recent grants that allowed us to buy and protect habitat. And there are other lands that are for production organic farming that are intended to serve as an endowment for stewardship learning, but also generate revenue to support the educational activities in the trust.
It's huge, 600 acres. How did it get started?
Well, with a $500 down payment.
And this was like 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, and I was teaching school in Northeast Portland in something called the Sacagawea Living Lab, where we were working with kids using this curiosity-based learning principle. And the kids were a lot more interested in what was going on the fence outside the playground than they were within the asphalt zone where they were confined. And when I had a chance, an old college buddy who I had been helping with his partner to take care of their farm in the gorge, when it turned out they were going to split up and sell the farm, he asked if we would like to buy it. And I asked my kids, and they all thought about it for about 9 seconds. And
these are the kids that you were teaching.
That's right. They said, sure, let's buy a farm. And so we moved the rooster that we had in town out into the gorge.
And now you have something called the Highland Center there?
Well, that's an ambitious title. The work has been, the real work these last decades has been to get the land out of the money system. And it's not a commune, and it's not a private for-profit farm. It's an endowment for stewardship learning, permanently protected. And we still have the numbers get big when you're talking land with timber on it. So the last payment was over $1 million, and the next one's going to be more than that. So these are not small numbers. But once we're past this next cycle, we're at a very interesting point because we're now into the business of building sustaining working facilities and the staff and programs that can use that endowment to teach about stewardship and managing resources as though the future mattered.
And you're working with other agencies to endow it or to maintain, like the Columbia Land Trust and...
There are two land trusts that we've been partnering with to support the very clear goals that were laid out in the original large grant, which was from the Paul Allen Ancient Forest Foundation, Forest Protection Foundation, and they were, he was incredibly generous. He put in over $1 million. And that was matched by my original trustees, including Gifford and Libba Pinchot, who founded the Bainbridge Graduate Institute. And their commitment and others, Paul Libby early on and his partner Mary and Otis and Jane Mulder Wolin made that original match possible. And then subsequently we've had agency participation. The Washington DNR with funds from the Endangered Species Act was a big piece of the what we called phase one of a partnership with the DNR that was funded from Section 6 of the Endangered Species Act. And then after that, another grant for phase two, which allowed us to protect the upper half of the Highland complex. It's the lower half of Highland that's still in the fundraising domain. And at that point, we're really excited because we have an endowment to support a model of stewardship learning based on kids actually managing a farm and a forest.
So what happens with these kids? What are they doing there?
Well, Amiel, what did we do yesterday?
Well, yesterday we had 4 kids up on ladders picking cherries. Day before that, we're driving tractors, welding. I mean, there's all sorts of things. It's constantly learning, constantly doing things, getting your hands actually dirty.
Yeah. And how many kids maybe are showing up to do this?
It depends on the day. I mean, at the moment, there are like 3 or 4 kids just around almost, every day working, doing things, gardening, planting seeds?
It's small. You know, family-sized stuff is the most effective. We call it the work group. You know, two adults and five kids would be a big project. We partner with Portland schools and other groups that want to bring their learning community into the landscape, but we do it in small bites. So the Portland Waldorf School has been with us for, I think, 8 years now, but it's never more than six kids at a time.
Uh-huh. And so, but it's sort of a revolving open door of different kids and getting their hands dirty and learning how to do these things.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
The dirt is a big piece of it.
The dirt is a big piece. Yeah, and so what do you feel like you've been learning there then?
Oh, a huge number of things. I mean,
of course, you've been living there your whole life.
Yes, that helps, definitely. Yeah.
Well, she's an astrophysicist with a welding torch.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's wonderful to partner. Like, I love learning and I love school, and I've been doing early college and learning physics and mathematics in my time in Portland, but then I go and I'm welding, which is one of my favorites, or I'm pulling out, you know, species that are invasive, or, I mean, I'm mowing hay. It's nearly dusk, and I'm lifting all the hay bales on the second layer of the truck, you know. It's things that really help in getting things done.
Yeah. It's interesting because I think kids are hungry to do real work. Our crazy modern culture.
Yeah, you said curiosity-based learning.
Yeah, well, that's an important entry point. If you take the time to find out what a young person is interested in and then shape the learning process around that, all the discipline problems go away. But if you have a curriculum and the child's got to begin on page one and you say, open the book and sit down and shut up, it's not a very cooperative learning process. So we say, let the kids go. Let them out into nature and discover what they care about. Some of them are going to be interested in the cherry at the top of the ladder, and others are going to be up with the horse or working with plants in the garden around the greenhouse and so forth. And once they find something they care about, then it's like feeding a fire. You just bring more fuel.
And this, so it's really a school that you're operating there.
Well, it's a process. Yeah. And it's a family process. And I think we underestimate how much learning can actually go on if you give kids a way to move forward on their own, teach them how to teach themselves.
And you're also, really briefly, you're involved with stuff around the world, something called the Eden Project, a project in Costa Rica. You have a bunch of different projects going on as part of World Steward.
Well, that sounds more ambitious than it really is. We have allies who are doing similar things in other places. If the listeners are not acquainted with the Eden Project in Cornwall, you really should be, because it's what Tim Smith, who founded it, calls the largest tropical forest in captivity. They've built a massive complex of geodesic domes over an ancient Cornish rock quarry.
So this is all in England?
Southern England, yes. Yeah. And there they've developed a teaching facility about the relationship between plants and people. And it's incredibly beautiful and interesting. And the concern of the Eden group has been that kids have become disconnected from landscapes. So we share that value system. And the president of their foundation, Tony Kendall, has been a major supporter of the development of intergenerational financial instruments.
And Amory Levins as well, which I want to get to. This is KBOO, KBOO, Portland, Locus Focus, and I'm guest host today, Stephanie Potter, speaking with Hank Patton and his daughter,
Amiela the Baba.
Amiel Patton Hall. Anyway, he comes to us, they both come to us from the Columbia Gorge. Hank is founder and chairman of World Steward, and he's also designed the concept of intergenerational finance, which is actually a trademarked real concept here that has this incredible potential, it seems like, to really make a lot of changes in the world. So we're going to get to that. We're going to get first here to Amory Levins. He's famous for a lot of reasons, but one of the really important and revolutionary ideas that he's best known for is called the negawatt. That's like negative watt. The negawatt is basically a kilowatt of energy that is saved by a conservation investment, like insulating the attic or swapping a compact fluorescent light for an incandescent light bulb. And it gets made available without building a new power plant. So it seems to me that business, as if the future matters, will involve a lot of investment in efficiency of all kinds. And Amory himself has gotten involved in developing intergenerational finance with you. As I said in the beginning, he's called it one of maybe the most brilliant ideas that's come out in the last 20th century. So who else is involved? And could you give us just maybe to start with a description of how intergenerational finance works or could work?
Well, there's a lot there. Amory's interest, of course, is in the...
Oh, and by the way, if listeners want to call in, the phone number here is 503-231-8187. Okay, sorry.
Sure. The key idea is actually very much related to what you just described. Stephanie, she is the Amory's work in developing a market for things that don't happen is a key element in the new class of long-term savings instrument that would underwrite a business partnership with future generations. The fundamental insight in this concept is that by including what economists call externalities, the hidden costs of energy, which include, for example, these oil trains coming down the gorge and the possibility of a coal export plant on the coastline in the Northwest, by including those true costs, including the people who have to eat the dust off of the trains and so forth.
People who get asthma.
All of that.
And pollution to the watershed.
The methyl mercury that comes out of the coal that causes mental retardation and early male heart attacks. It goes on and on and on. The coal combustion waste. Coal may be low priced, but it's not cheap. It's not low cost. And by including the true costs of our energy investments, we begin to understand that the so-called more expensive choice, which would be the solar and renewable and radically efficient integrated design, is actually the cheaper and more productive investment opportunity. The problem has been that future generations up until IGF didn't write checks. So we're now using the same long-term financial instrument and science-based standards to develop a market for the co-beneficial outcomes, the things that don't happen, that you don't want to have happen, the sickness that you don't want to have, the water quality problems that you don't want to have, the coal combustion dams that you don't want to break and get into your city's water table, and the things you do want to have happen, like the resilience in your community that comes from energy that's produced on top of your own home, and other benefits that can be measured. You mentioned earlier, Stephanie, the trademark, and the trademark is we've placed on intergenerational finance and the IGF so that the terms can never be used except in concert with the full set of science-based, third-party vetted contract metrics. We call them contract metrics because there are going to be secondary markets for these co-beneficial outcomes. The wellness outcome, the security outcomes, which are very big, obviously, the resource recovery outcomes that can be measured and delivered, and there are others. So the basic idea is we're creating a system by which local communities can use the same credit that we use for other bond instruments to develop capital funds that invest in the retirement of dirty, destructive systems and the replacement of those systems with clean, radically efficient, resilient alternatives.
Okay, so where do we get the money for this? Because, I mean, I was reading trillions, potentially trillions of dollars or could be made available.
Well, the global finance community has figured out how to move trillions of dollars. And what's interesting is one class of investor in that big-ticket bank-driven system is called the reinsurance industry, and that's the groups that insure the insurance companies. There was a statement by a group called the ClimateWise Reinsurance Group at the Durban Climate Summit in South Africa that made an incredibly important and, I think, cornerstone change in the way the large financial interests are looking at climate change. They realized, the reinsurance companies stated, that, and this is a group that collectively holds three and a half trillion.
There's our trillions.
These folks are quite aware because their actuaries are showing them, and these risks are in their books, so they calculate this stuff carefully. Of that 3.5 trillion, 95% was tied up in high carbon fixed assets like shopping malls and building towers and so forth. They're actually creating the problems that they have to insure against. This is a train wreck, and they can see it in their books. You can't go on building these high carbon systems that then create a high carbon crisis that you have to pay for with what? The cash flow from the high carbon? I don't think so. So they want to relocate those trapped investments. And the instrument we're describing is a more resolved version of what is now called green bond financing, because instead of voluntary standards, it would use science-based third-party contract metrics. And there are secondary markets for some of these outcomes. It's cheaper, as any doctor will tell you, to intervene early in the life of a teenager before that child becomes obese and has health problems related to obesity. So early intervention is actually very cost-effective, and as part of our intergenerational investment in wellness, there should be much more focused early intervention work. Our governor in this state, very clear in his insight that early intervention creates value, and he's been quite entrepreneurial in encouraging the communities to figure out ways to deliver on that equation. And other early intervention strategies exist throughout the value chain. But the most important thing about IGF is that suddenly you have a market at a system scale. So you can afford to talk about early retirement of a coal thermal plant and capturing the value of not operating that toxic asset. But until you have a way of throwing $500 million at the or more at the problem, you can't talk about it because there's no way to finance it.
Right. People don't want to retire it. They've got a lot tied up in it, that kind of thing.
That's what we call the trapped equity problem, and it drives the entire political process. People have a vested interest in doing the wrong thing, and guess what? They hire a politician to defend their interests.
Right. This gives, including the Koch brothers.
Boy, I'll say. And I'm not sure we're going to be well received in that particular setting. But the reality is, these are business calculations. And the key idea underlying intergenerational partnership is that you create more value by managing resources as though the future mattered.
And these reinsurance companies then would actually care about the future. I mean, they have more of a sense of the future mattering. Because what I get a sense of a lot is that there's a very short-term focus in the economy.
Short and narrow.
Yeah.
Short and narrow.
But
we think about
the reinsurance people are different somehow.
Well, there are two very reliable forces on planet Earth. One of them is called gravity, and the other is called
greed.
Yeah. Well, it's called self-interest. But the insurance companies have to manage their assets. I mean, they're in the business of managing assets to create cash that then is used to solve big problems when they occur. And they do it with margin. They have to make a spread or they're going to go broke. So, I wouldn't say that they're particularly altruistic in their way of thinking about it. They're very businesslike. But and IGF is kind of cold-blooded, frankly, in that it looks at the fundamental premise that if you manage resources correctly over the term across the full spectrum of consequences, you're going to create more wealth and opportunity and richness and security and beauty and wellness than you do with the model we're using. So it's not a question of whether or not we can do it. It's a question of, do we have a framework in which we can make the superior investments? And that's what it's all about. And the fact that somebody gets rich doing a good thing doesn't bother me at all. And if it's a traditional kind of margin, we used to think that, 3% or 4% was a great return, works for me. Mm-hmm. If you look at a zucchini, you get a lot more than that in the course of a three-month
right.
window.
and then you had an example. I was reading, that the way to start thinking about things more holistically, there was, I think it was a laundromat and a greenhouse. And could you sort of talk about how, just the way we would change our thinking then?
Well, designing whole systems. This was a wonderful exercise that we did a study that was funded by the wonderful Miller Family Foundation through the Institute for Sustainable Solutions at PSU, and a great group of grad students. And one of the things that the case studies that we use when people say, well, let's make this real in the village so we can understand what you're talking about, you consider a old traditional natural gas powered laundromat, and across the street you've got a propane powered greenhouse. Those two systems are obviously hemorrhaging energy, and they're
CO2 into the atmosphere.
CO2 into the atmosphere, hot water into the drains, and very inefficient, but if the energy is cheap and you can make a nickel, hey. And of course, back when the price of natural gas was going up, if it did go up and you had to put new coin slots on all your washing machines, it could put you out of business. So you're not thinking about rebuilding the whole thing. Until suddenly the opportunity comes through a redevelopment district or an eco district in your neighborhood watershed that suddenly has capital that says, how could you rebuild in partnerships that reduce waste and increase efficiency and create new opportunities for wealth creation?
And this is being funded by one of these super maybe reinsurance companies or something.
Well, they're a market for, obviously, they've got big buildings. We're talking laundromats here. But
yeah,
if you have an office tower in New York that's inefficient, and Amory has worked on many of those, including the Empire State Building's retrofit, which is incredibly cost effective, it turns out. But let's go back to the laundromat.
Right.
Here you have local, you know, now you're heating a greenhouse with the waste heat of the laundromat. You're producing the hot water with solar panels that were assembled by local people. You've got a preschool or a nursery or a coffee house space in the between the two of them that's full of green things and fun to be in, and heated for free. The organic material from the university cafeteria goes into a biodigester. The biodigester is producing gas to produce the hot water and supplement the solar hot water, because you're going to need a lot of hot water, obviously, in a laundromat. And you've chosen your nutrients that are going through the laundromat so that they don't destroy soil organisms. And, you know, it's a whole system,
right,
designed to last and be recycled and sustain and create efficiency and value, many classes of value. And some of those classes of value are sellable in the, you know, secondary markets,
and then
like the avoided carbon.
And then all of this would be happening in like regions or biodistricts or like watersheds. I mean, like a whole area.
Well, we imagine that, yeah, the redevelopment bond idea, it's a savings bond, basically.
Uh-huh.
And in the early stages, it will have the full faith and credit. But if your standards, if the metrics are rigorous and you can't give the money to projects that don't use the full spectrum of standards, I don't think the full faith and credit is going to be an essential component of capitalizing projects. But I'll take the Klamath Basin. There's an extraordinary geothermal resource available there, but it's expensive to develop.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a permanent source of zero carbon energy after you've built the infrastructure. And you've got a farming community that's struggling with the loss of water, so they don't have the prospect for their own children to stay on the farm. If you were to build, and I'm not telling people what to do, but one line of action that has certainly been discussed is that those geothermal resources could support greenhouse complexes that allowed the Klamath Basin to supply local food to the West Coast. And
it looks like we have a caller on the phone. Hang on a second.
Sure.
I just want to let listeners know that I'm speaking with Hank Patton. His daughter, Amiel, is
Amiela.
Here. Amiela. I'll never get it. Anyway, is here too. And Hank is the founder of World Steward out in the Gorge. He's also creating a finance program that could really change the world. If we got to get it going soon here, though. And it's called Intergenerational Finance. It's actually even trademarked. And Thomas, what was your... Oh, and this is KBOO Portland. I'm Stephanie Potter, guest hosting here for the Locus Focus Show. And Thomas, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, what would you like to ask us?
Yes, good morning. I really like the spirit and some of the ideas of your guests. And I do want to voice a real concern I have with part of the model that's being suggested, which has to do with utilizing the existing financial system or market system for supporting progressive energy and other environmental issues. You know, I think there's a couple really fundamental dangers in putting too much weight on such a system. One is, you know, a fundamentally sane system, even with serious problems, is a fixable system. I think we really have to go a long way to show that the existing system, market system, and finance system is a fundamentally sane system, and not indeed the core of the problem. You know, and if we talk about these trillions of dollars, you know, it's almost like we have to premise the discussion on an already artificial discussion about the scarcity of finances, when in fact this whole idea that there's a scarcity of finances and that finances are created through this Wall Street investment model is essentially a sort of folklore that's been promulgated and underwritten by those who have the biggest vested interest. And I understand, you know, the whole idea about, you know, turning the snake against biting its own tail and all that, but the thing is, at the end of the day, with supporting such a model, it seems to me like we end up keeping the same fundamental problem, which is effective minority control of our financial resources. And at the end of the day, if something changes and they decide that it's just as profitable to go right back and do something else that's negative, then they have the freedom to do it. You know, and this is all in opposition. It's almost like we're just capitulating and saying, you know what, you win. You know, we're going to play by your game. We're going to make a Mephistophelian pact, and then we're going to trust you. And, you know, it's a lot like the whole carbon trading discussion. And there seems to be a growing mountain of evidence by scholars showing that even the ideas of carbon trading is very, very dubious, and that there's a million ways to game the system. If we've learned one thing since the big mortgage fraud crisis and then the giant international banking fraud crisis recently, is that these people in those positions of power have the ability and the knowledge. They're more than capable of gaming the system. So I'm just worried that you know, if we put too much reality on the derivatives and all these economic instruments, we are just going to end up being in a situation where we're never going to have what we need, which is popular democratic control of institutions, regulations, and you know what? A law. We used to have a thing called laws and regulations where we said, no, it's not a matter of we're going to give you carrot, endless carrot after carrot, but we're actually going to tell you, you know what? No, this is not in accordance with public opinion and the public good and the good of society. We're just going to say no.
Okay.
So that's my only concern. My concern. Thanks for taking my call.
That's great, Thomas. And actually, that was going to be one of my questions down the road here, is how do we keep the bad guys from gaming the system? So can you address Thomas's concerns?
It's a great question, Thomas. And we've designed IGF with a lot of rigor to be based on science, not on politics. You can't make a market in something you don't measure. And if you allow the good old boys to decide what you're going to spend the money on, you're going to get exactly what Thomas is describing. I think he's totally correct in his concern. And so I don't agree that we're going to get any useful laws out of the Congress and presently. Perhaps I misheard him, but my basic premise is we have to use markets because that's what we've got. I can make it through the week without spending a lot of money, some weeks without spending any money, but sooner or later, if I need something, I wind up writing a check. And the money is coming from the good old boys system, no doubt about that, which is why intergenerational finance is designed in a modular way. You can't do a piece of something. The carbon market is a shuck in the sense that it's just a piece, and it's a part of a game that's being played. I don't mean to imply that you can't actually get some progress in carbon reduction with a carbon market, but it's just one of a whole range of values that can be delivered by completely retiring what we call a legal dirty asset. One of the projects that's in an advanced stage of development right now is a proposal to use intergenerational finance to retire the Navajo Generating Station, which is a pair of 750 megawatt. It's the largest and dirtiest coal plant, basically, on the West Coast. It's on the Colorado Plateau. and use IGF to replace it with a full spectrum of whole system, radically clean and efficient solar and efficiency on demand side capabilities, including designed to support cultural heritage and capacity building in the First Peoples communities of the plateau, and designed by and implemented by the First People, not by white folks who think they have a better idea. So the trick here is it's a whole system, and it's the resources are drawing from global finance. And by the way, those cowboys aren't going to go away. You know, our view is we create a better game because there's more wealth in these clean whole systems, and they're more stable, and they're more secure, and they're more fun. At the end of the day, stable is a big deal if you're managing $1 trillion worth of capital. And we think that these sustaining models are going to be more attractive to global finance. If they're not doing smart, efficient, good stuff, guess what they're going to do? They're going to do whatever they can do. Sometimes they just play with currency speculation. One of our key players is advisors is Hazel, the amazing Hazel Henderson. If you don't know her work, you should surf into it. She wrote The Politics of the Solar Age, and I spoke at her conference in Florida here a couple months ago, and a longtime friend and advisor. And Hazel's view is that currency speculation, she's one of the proponents of the Tobin tax, to tax international currency speculation, and finance international community and law that way. A very good idea, but that requires the parliaments to act. IGF can act without the parliaments. It's a market-based opportunity for communities to redesign themselves, to go bounty hunting and find dirty assets, retire them soon, and get credit for it using science.
And so this really depends, though, on scientific measurable outcomes. And how does that get implemented, or how does that work?
Well, that's why we have actually, if you read some of the short summaries of IGF, the intent is to convey control of the trademark and the IP associated with intergenerational finance to the International Union for Science or some appropriate international
real
scientific
scientists. Not corporate scientists.
No, well, these aren't people working for the man. These are people who are famous and expert in their own communities. Dr. Lubchenko, whom we are very own from OSU, who's work in marine reserves, is a famous example of partnering with the future, because it actually turns out to be good for the fishing community if you get it right. Complex equation, as the fishermen listening will know, but it is worth investing in reserves so that you have fish for your children. Hal Mooney, who co-chaired the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, Dennis Bushnell, who's the chief scientist at NASA Langley, Dr. Rita Colwell, a former head of the National Science Foundation, Carl Hodges, a brilliant halophyte specialist who's chairman of the Seawater Foundation. These are people whose credentials are impeccable in science and are leaders in the science community. Dr. Colwell is a specialist in the health consequences of environmental issues, and she knows very well, as I was describing earlier, that intervening early in a health crisis is the cheapest and sometimes the only way to create the outcome that you really want, which is people who are not sick.
But there would have to be a lot of transparency with this, it seems like.
It has to be. And it has to be voluntary. We think that's a key. You don't have to. It's not like we're going to come in and shut you down. If you want to play, fine. If you don't, that's fine too. We think that radically efficient, integrated, renewable systems are more competitive and more stable and are more likely to be here after the big whatever. And a lot of people think that's true. Some people don't. That's okay. It's also critical that you use standard contract metrics, because that allows the outcomes to be sold in secondary markets. Now, the carbon market is one of those places. The wellness market and security markets are going to be very big because it's cheaper to intervene before you have a war. And there are a lot of, a refugee crisis is an expensive problem to have. And from the perspective of future generations, they would rather that communities were resilient and self-sustaining. If war is your only choice, that's probably what you're going to get. Sustaining resources is is more fun, and we think it would be more profitable.
Yeah, I get, it's funny, like, because then you end up, though, like, probably in a fight with people who are building, you know, bombers and things like that. I mean, there are people who are profiting from
that's called the trap.
That
that's called the trapped equity problem, and, right. and we meet it front on. I think if you're in the razor wire business, security, you know, a village where nobody is afraid of it, losing anything is
you're going to lose. Your
it's bad for business, you know. Right. So if you have a if you're in the landmine business, I mean, it's interestingly, the United States turns out is going to get out of the landmine business, so somebody. Down at the contractor window at the Pentagon is not a happy camper because they're not going to be making landmines. Amazing to imagine that our democracy, I mean, it's not that amazing, but at any rate, we know that that's kind of junk is going on. And by giving the defense industry an opportunity to become a part of the security industry by building more sustaining, in if you have an asset base and you want to stop or transition to a cleaner and more sane and sensible and productive way of employing human beings and resources, then you can bid. Because the
and you bid on these things.
You will yeah. you will bring, you'll say, I'm employing 800 people doing X, Y, and Z, and we would like to retire that plant and rebuild it to serve the following objectives, and we're partnering with this school district and this water district. And the richer the equation, the more probable that you will have access to the investment capital that is being represented on behalf of future generations by trustees who control the assets, the investment capital that comes from the saving bond, and it has to be used with the contract metrics based upon science.
And we're getting close to the end here, but you were saying, for instance, this is happening at a Navajo reservation. Well,
this is one of the places where it's being discussed.
Discussed.
It's being discussed in the application in the Anacostia watershed, which is in Washington, D.C. We have an international project being developed for the production of halophytes or saltwater loving plants and wasteland in Aruba in concert with the Netherlands. It's an independent country with a very interesting set of development issues, and they're interested in using intergenerational financial markets as a way of developing those assets. And also in the Hudson Valley in New York, recycling organic waste, diverting organic waste from the New York City waste stream. So lots of different applications.
You work with with the government as well as with businesses then? And would laws have to change to make this really work?
Well, you know, that as I said in response to Thomas's good question, we don't think that the present process is working in a way that would support business. And I think most of the business people listening here would agree that if you have to wait for Congress to pass the bill you need, you're going to wait for a while.
Uh-huh.
So we're just going to move ahead with markets, and markets work fine. And there are a lot, the KBU community is particularly good at reading the ingredients. I think this is what it's going to take. You vote with your money for products and process that are superior, and they're good for the future.
Uh-huh. So then finally, really quick, you worked with Leighton Marsh and the Institute for Sustainable Solutions at PSU, and it was a 170-page comparative analysis of intergenerational finance as an alternative and market-based approach to social environmental problems. There's a lot of discussion about new markets for co-beneficial outcomes. So these markets then, are there things then besides the reinsurance company? What are some other markets?
Well, in the Northwest, we've got some really wonderful examples. In the Tualatin, there's a market for water temperature, which makes it salmon habitat more viable. In other words, you could actually get a contract to put shade on the edge of the river so the fish do better.
Uh-huh.
So that's a co-beneficial outcome. You know, it is.
And these markets exist now?
That one does, yes.
Uh-huh.
There are obviously markets for wellness outcomes, which are going to be a big piece since we are seeing not a pretty set of environmentally related problems. And there are markets for social outcomes, including, and this is where IGF becomes interesting because you can actually assemble, aggregate, and jointly fund
all
projects that deliver social and environmental outcomes, like avoided recidivism.
I just want to say I really thank you for showing up. I've been speaking with Hank Patton. He's the founder, and his daughter, Amiel.
And we're getting there.
And created the Intergenerational Finance and founder and chairman of Royal Steward, located in the Columbia Gorge, doing a lot of things for the, as if the future mattered with our resources. I'm Stephanie Potter, guest host for Locus Focus here on KBOO Radio. And I want to thank our engineer, Kate, who's done a fabulous job, and thank you for tuning in.
And you do have it tuned to KBOO in Portland. Coming right up at 11 is a special edition of Health and Healthcare Forum with host Roberta Hall. She interviews investigative journalist David K. Johnston about healthcare inequality. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
This is Mary Graham. My husband Donnie Graham, after being down 20 years in prison, was shot and killed by the Clackamas County Sheriff. My four beautiful daughters were taken by the state. I turned to drugs to ease the pain. Listen to my story of healing and hope on Prison Pipeline.
That's Prison Pipeline, June 30th at 6:30 p.m.
This is Mary Graham. My husband Donnie Graham, after being down 20 years in prison, was shot and killed by the Clackamas County Sheriff. Were taken by the state. I turned to drugs to ease the pain. Listen to my story of healing and hope on Prison Pipeline.
That's Prison Pipeline, June 30th at 6:30 p.m.